Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Jeff Oxnard from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. And to begin, I asked him about an important issue in lung cancer management and one where he's had a central leadership role, specifically the use of liquid biopsies.
The appeal of cell-free DNA is that we want to offer precision cancer care to our lung cancer patients. And to do that, we need the tumor DNA. And the frustrating part is that biopsies are inconvenient. Biopsies take time, have risks, and often don't give us enough tissue. And so we want to get access to tumor DNA non-invasively, thus the liquid biopsy, which is so rewarding because we can take that blood test, hand it directly to the pathology lab, get the genetic testing going, okay? It's so rapid, the result can come back to us within a week often. And so it's compelling but has limitations because in that patient with advanced lung cancer, there may or may not be tumor DNA floating around. And I think in advanced lung cancer, the chance of there being a good circulating DNA in that patient may be 70% of the time. And so sometimes, most of the time, we can trust that liquid biopsy as being reflective of the tumor. But other times, if their cancer is more indolent, if they're more asymptomatic, there will be no tumor DNA floating around. And what we don't know is whether that liquid biopsy is a good biopsy or a bad biopsy. That's what we have to figure out. And so you send off that blood test hoping to find something. And if you get back an actionable result, an EGFR, an ALK, a ROS, a BRAF, a HER2, a MET, if you get back a resistance mutation you can target, then you can trust it and you can say, aha, I got a good result. This can help the patient. But if you don't get back a meaningful result, you're left saying, ugh, maybe I missed the mutation. Maybe I need to fall back on the tumor biopsy, which remains the most reliable reference test for getting a genotype.
Can you talk a little bit, without necessarily going into a lot of specifics, although if it's relevant, go right ahead, about the various options, about types of assays that are available now for an oncologist to choose from, and how you think the decision should be made?
The two broad types are a focused test that looks at a single mutation, like a PCR approach, and the FDA-approved test, the COBAS EGFR test, is a very reliable but very focused test looking for EGFR mutations in T790M. And then the other approach is the broad approach, which is the next-generation sequencing approach, like those offered by many companies, where you look at a whole range of genes. And the question is, for your patient, is your question focused? Or is your question broad? In my practice, increasingly, my questions are broad, right? Indeed, now that we are pretty good at suppressing T790M with osimertinib, our questions are more and more a potential range of resistance mutations. And so I'm increasingly offering NGS-based tests to my patient, looking not just for one mutation, but looking for any number of different mutations. The advantage of the focus test is it's really reliable and really well validated. The risk of the NGS test is that you get back mutations you weren't looking for. For example, you get back a JAK mutation, which is not actually their tumor mutation, but is their white cell mutation. You get back germline BRCA mutations sometimes with your plasma NGS test. So when you send a plasma NGS test, you're asking more questions and you're getting a lot more data back to sift through and figure out. And if you're willing to understand and spend time interpreting that, I think there's a lot of details you can get on the NGS test.
We're starting to see also predictors of response to immunotherapy that we're seeing with NGS tumor mutation burden, et cetera. Can any of that be assessed with a plasma sample?
I'm not convinced that plasma NGS gives you mutational burden, right? Original mutational burden data came from whole exome sequencing, every gene. And then it's been developed looking at broad, like Foundation Medicine-like panels, hundreds of genes. Plasma NGS panels are really just focused on around 50 genes, maybe 80 genes. It's a much more focused coverage. And that focused coverage, I'm not convinced it gives you enough of the genome to give you mutational burden. And so I still think plasma NGS is a shortcut. It still is not as good as tumor NGS. It's a quick way at looking for mutations you can act upon when time is tight, when the patient is sick. But if you have tumor, if you're taking out a brain tumor, if you are taking out a pleural effusion, if there's a palpable lymph node, I think that the easy biopsy gives you a better specimen that gives you more answers than a liquid biopsy alternative.
Do we know anything about sort of what the mechanism is that you see this shedding? Do you see it more with advanced disease? And what's the pathophysiology?
Yeah, it's not clear. Some have proposed it's actually an independent marker of metastaticness or even of prognosis. So shedding cancers are worse prognosis, non-shedding cancers are better prognosis. In some studies, in some of our work, we found it more associated with more sites of disease, more likely to shed, bone mets, liver mets more likely to shed. So certainly it's related to stage, right? Stage 1 and 2 cancers, we found, for example, in our data presented at ASCO, that you're less likely to find tumor DNA floating around, and you're more likely to find it in advanced cancers. And in your more symptomatic, more disease burden cancers, you're more likely to see a meaningful result. And so if I have a patient with tiny lung nodules, I'm really not going to send a liquid biopsy. I don't think I'm going to see anything floating around in their blood. If I have a patient with an aggressive symptomatic cancer, I actually feel like a liquid biopsy is more likely to give me a meaningful result, and so I'll send it quick to get a result back before I start on treatment.
What are some of the clinical scenarios that you think are most appropriate to be thinking about this? I'm sure that you see a lot of second opinions where you think to yourself, oh, they should have maybe done a plasma assay at that point. What are some of the most valuable situations to consider this?
In my practice, it's the patient who's first presenting with advanced non-small cell lung cancer, and they're symptomatic, and I think I need to get started on treatment soon, right? Their specimen is small. Maybe it's already used up getting PD-L1 testing, another important biomarker you can't get in the blood. And what I want to do is rule out EGFR, ALK, ROS, BRAF, the key stuff. And so I send a liquid biopsy while I am planning chemo. And so I say, look, we're going to start chemo in 10 days. I need 10 days to get everything lined up, to get insurance approval, but I'm going to send a liquid biopsy today. And because your disease is symptomatic, is metastatic to the bone, I suspect this is going to be a good specimen. I'm going to get meaningful result back in the blood. And I get that back in a week and a half in time to decide if I should instead change the plan and start targeted therapy or proceed with chemo or immunotherapy or chemoimmunotherapy.
Of course, if you do that, there is the risk that maybe the plasma assay will be negative, but it'll be positive in the tissue.
Right, and maybe what I get back on the liquid biopsy is not a lot, low-level mutations, maybe just a little P53, something non-interpretable, and I say, ugh, that was not that meaningful. It doesn't replace tumor NGS for you. And I say, well, do we proceed with biopsy, which could take time, or do we proceed with empiric chemo and remind myself that this is a patient who is ungenotyped? The key is that patient needs to go down as someone where the genotype still needs to be pursued. And so, yeah, it ends up being a shortcut which doesn't pan out for all patients. The biggest risk then is if you send that liquid biopsy in the low burden asymptomatic patient where you don't find anything else, right? And so proceeding down a liquid biopsy approach for a patient who shouldn't get it because they're not a shedding cancer might lead you in the wrong direction. And so in those patients where there's not a lot of disease burden, you need to use a biopsy in the conventional approach. The other question is in resistance, the same way. Sometimes in resistance, you have more time. You send a liquid biopsy first, you look for the result, you don't see the T790M or the ALK resistance mutation, and you say, that was not helpful for us. Fallback plan, we got to get a biopsy.
You mentioned bone. Are there special issues when the tissue is bone that you're getting the biopsy from?
Yeah, it's a great point. It's hard to get good specimens out of bone biopsies. It's hard to get good specimens out of pleural effusions sometimes. There's a lot of tumor that's hard to get good specimens out of. It's hard to get good specimens out of lungs sometimes. Bone in particular is difficult because you have to decalcify it, and so you have to ask your pathologist to handle it in a way that will let you get genomics. And so bone biopsies sometimes offer less yield, unfortunately.
Let's talk about management of patients with EGFR tumor mutations and specifically your current approach to first-line treatment of metastatic disease.
First-line osimertinib is now my standard of care based upon the results of the FLAURA trial showing better PFS, just as good or at least as good response rate, potentially better survival. Yeah, this is our new standard. You know, we're excited about osimertinib first line because it also reflects a backbone for even better combination therapies. So we have a lot of clinical trials first line with osimertinib we're now enrolling to. But I do have patients who are starting first line osimertinib. It's great because it works in the brain, it's tolerable. You don't really get dose interruptions. You rarely get dose adjustments. It's a very easy drug. It's an effective drug that's good for patients and good for providers.
Any patient that you can think of that you've seen, you know, recently where you started on first-line osimertinib you can talk about?
Sure. So I saw a patient in his 60s, still working full-time. He's a non-smoker. He traveled up from another state for a consultation about first-line EGFR therapy, and his local doc had proposed osimertinib. I proposed the same thing. He does have brain mets, and we were trying to avoid brain radiation, which I'm increasingly doing in these patients who live longer, right? EGFR mutants have a good prognosis. Brain radiation can have long-term toxicities. And so I'm increasingly offering first-line EGFR therapy instead of brain radiation. And so we wanted a drug that would be tolerable. We wanted a drug that would work in the brain and avoid the need for brain radiation. And so we started first-line osimertinib about 80 milligrams a day. He tolerated it great. He had actually very few toxicities, a little bit of dry skin, and was traveling up to see me, and actually now has decided to stick with his local doc because things are going smoothly. And these patients eventually can be seen every couple of months until that time comes when resistance develops and we have to sort of revisit what to do next.
Can you talk a little bit more about the sites of disease and the amount of disease, and particularly in the brain?
In this patient, he had some symptomatic lung disease, had a cough, had some lung nodules and infiltrates, and in the brain had multiple brain metastases with some mild edema. Not a lot of symptoms. It was not a high burden of brain disease in terms of symptoms. We felt confident that we could get systemic therapy on board. He wouldn't need urgent radiation. And that's the main challenge. When patients have high burden of brain disease, you struggle with, should you do radiation first to make sure that you can get that response before osimertinib. He had, you know, a couple centimeter brain mets and had multiple brain mets, more than I would use with SRS. I had 5 or 6 brain mets, and I felt like systemic therapy was the right way to start.
And you said he did have some symptoms. What kind of symptoms did he have from the brain?
No, his symptoms were respiratory. He did not have neurologic symptoms, yeah.
Respiratory, right. You know, this came out in a conference you were involved with recently where we had a patient who had some mild numbness in one hand, had a brain met. The patient had gotten corticosteroids. The numbness resolved, but technically they were symptomatic.
Yeah.
Will minimal symptoms, you still would consider systemic therapy rather than radiation?
The trial I'm most impressed by was a randomized trial in China of an EGFR inhibitor, icotinib, versus whole brain radiation in patients like this with multiple brain mets. And actually, icotinib had a better response rate in the brain, right? EGFR inhibitors, even EGFR inhibitors of yesterday, can be very effective in the brain. And so unless it's critical symptoms where I'm really nervous and I need whole brain, I am often using TKI first for, yes, symptomatic brain mets. You know, what's great about oral therapy is it works quickly. You know in a week if the patient's doing better. It may work more quickly than brain radiation for treating symptoms. So I'm very confident that using targeted therapy up front, ALK therapy and EGFR therapy, instead of brain radiation, even for mildly symptomatic disease.
How about the patient who's eligible to receive SRS? You still would go with the TKI?
It's a conversation with the patient. I think by using SRS, you feel more confident that you're getting on top of the brain disease quickly. But I've not always used SRS. Yes, I will sometimes use TKI.
You mentioned the FLAURA trial and osimertinib, but we also saw data on dacomitinib. Can you talk a little bit about what that agent is and what the results are and what kind of future, if any, you see for this agent?
Dacomitinib is a second-generation EGFR inhibitor, much like afatinib. It is covalent. It hits EGFR as well as HER2. It's a pan-HER inhibitor. And it's dosed at a dose, at a max tolerable dose, which has toxicities. The main difference between dacomitinib and osimertinib in the view of the patient is that it has real toxicities. It causes mucositis, it causes diarrhea, it causes rash. In most patients on osimertinib, you won't see significant toxicities and you won't need dose reduction. In most patients on dacomitinib, you will see toxicities and you will need dose reduction. And so in a patient-centric drug development era, a drug with this kind of toxicity like dacomitinib, I don't see it being adopted broadly from the patient perspective. It was exciting because it did beat gefitinib. It had a better PFS than gefitinib, and it looks like a better overall survival as well. And so that's a great example that we can develop better drugs, but I would rather have better drugs that are tolerable and drugs that work in the brain. The dacomitinib trial excluded brain metastases. And I think, I'm not sure that's practical for our patients where brain metastases are a real recurrent problem.
Just out of curiosity, how would you indirectly compare the efficacy of dacomitinib and osimertinib?
You know, it's hard to make an indirect comparison because the two trials had different populations. The FLAURA trial included brain mets. The dacomitinib trial excluded brain mets. And so I don't think you can make it direct. Again, I think the efficacy for both was better than our prior first-gen TKIs. But for both trials, you know, looking at two drugs that seem to do better, I want a drug that's better tolerated and controls brain mets and prevents resistance.
What about the patient who develops disease progression on osimertinib? Is there a role for repeat mutation testing, for example, plasma assay? Other than a clinical trial, is there any, you know, sort of logic in looking for other mutations?
It's a great question, and it's a dynamic space. We have new data coming out soon to try to fill that gap. What we see is that you can develop new EGFR mutations like C797S. Those new EGFR mutations might be able to be treated with our prior EGFR inhibitors like gefitinib, erlotinib, afatinib. And so there may be still a role for sequential EGFR therapy in patients who are starting with osimertinib and then switching to the older EGFR inhibitors. That still needs to be proven. But beyond C797S, this new EGFR mutation, we can see acquired MET amplification. There are MET inhibitors on trial and off trial that can overcome MET resistance by adding them to an EGFR inhibitor. And I have rarely seen BRAF mutations, RET rearrangements. I've seen an acquired ALK rearrangement, acquired KRAS mutations. The better we inhibit EGFR, the more complex variety of resistance mechanisms we are starting to see in our EGFR mutant lung cancer. And so I think we need to develop treatment strategies that personalize resistance therapy by adding to that EGFR inhibitor other drugs which can control complex varieties of resistance.
For a creative oncologist or for a patient running out of options, is there a role right now for any of these strategies outside a protocol setting, a MET inhibitor, crizotinib, repeat erlotinib, any of these options that be considered?
Yeah. I mean, you need to be careful when you just stick drugs together, but I have patients on osimertinib plus crizotinib who weren't eligible for trials, and such cases have been reported. And I have a patient who've been on osimertinib plus crizotinib for MET-mediated resistance for a couple of years. Now, insurance sometimes gives him pushback, but it can be definitely an effective strategy and one that requires us to develop trials to address that need.
So you think, or you would keep the osimertinib going and then add in the other agent?
Yes, we still have the driver mutation. You haven't lost the EGFR. It's still EGFR addicted. But in all the preclinical data we see, you need to then add inhibition of the second pathway and see if you can then turn that into a response.
So that also leads into the issue of the patients, because there are many patients out there who are on erlotinib or afatinib or other agents. Any logic in switching them to osimertinib? For example, the patient is having a difficult time with toxicity, or even any other reason to just switch hoping for a better outcome?
Yeah, I have switched based on toxicity. It's not that uncommon for patients to have continued cutaneous toxicity on erlotinib, even when you've dose reduced down to 100 or 50 milligrams. And so some of those patients, I've switched over to osimertinib. And normally that goes smoothly. If a patient's doing well on erlotinib or afatinib without toxicity, I don't switch them. Because I have had a patient where I switched them to osimertinib, and actually, for whatever reason, they tolerated osimertinib even worse, and I switched them back. Patients don't like switching treatments spontaneously, right? They like sticking with drugs that are working. And so if they're tolerating it, and if they have a sustained response, I would not switch them over spontaneously unless there is obvious toxicity, and you have to have a conversation about that.
I want to move on in a second and talk about other genomic alterations. But I do want to ask you one of the pressing questions that's come out in the last couple of years and really getting into going beyond osimertinib after a patient develops progression. And the question there being, what is the role of checkpoint inhibitors in patients with targetable mutation? Is there any role for looking at PD-1 levels, tumor mutation burden? Where do things stand? We've been hearing the last couple of years about the concept of delaying using checkpoint inhibitors in these patients. Is that still where we're at?
Yeah, in my experience, I haven't seen a lot of activity of checkpoint inhibitors. It's sort of every so often you anecdotally see a response, but these genetically simple EGFR or ALK cancers aren't very sensitive. And so historically, what I've done is I've pushed out immune checkpoint inhibitors to maybe fourth line after failing a couple rounds of chemotherapy. I will say I, for the first time, treated a patient a month ago with the new approach of first-line chemotherapy plus a checkpoint inhibitor. And so this was a patient, an elderly woman. She had some COPD. She had EGFR mutant lung cancer, developed resistance, no T790M. My standard is chemotherapy with carbo-pem. And I offered her carbo-pem pembrolizumab. which is, as we know, a new approach we can use for ALK-negative, EGFR-negative non-small cell lung cancer. And I offered it to her off-label because she was a former smoker, actually. I thought there might be some potential of an immune response. And I think the data in this chemo-immuno combination does suggest some activity in non-smokers. And so I offered it off-label for EGFR mutant lung cancer. I will say so far, I don't have response scans yet. She has had toxicity, right? This is the risk. When you give more drugs, you have a higher risk of toxicity. And so she's had some respiratory symptoms, which might be her COPD or might be related to the immunotherapy. And we're managing that. I don't have any outcomes to report, but certainly in my EGFR mutant patients, when I offer them chemo, I'm having conversations about using chemo immunotherapy instead, really to give you that chance of a response up front and not save that for later line therapy.
What do we know about PD-1 levels and tumor mutation burden levels in people with targetable mutations, a typical non-smoker, for example?
We know that their mutational burden is lower because they're genetically more simple. So an EGFR or ALK is going to have a lower mutational burden. They can be PD-L1 positive, but the fact that they are PD-L1 positive on IHC does not mean they respond. And so when I see a high PD-L1 positive case with an EGFR mutation, I do not give them single agent pembrolizumab. You know, similarly, if I see a HER2 mutant or a RET rearranged case with high PD-L1 levels, I am reluctant to give them single agent pembrolizumab because I'm not confident that that's going to cause a response. I sort of see that as PD-L1 positive asterisk, right? And because it's so genetically simple, it's in effect a cold tumor that the immune system isn't interested in.
You mentioned the idea of combining osimertinib with other agents or EGFR TKIs with other agents. What are some of the strategies you're most excited about?
I think the most important is osimertinib plus a MET inhibitor. There's a clinical trial, the TATTON trial, which adds savolitinib to osimertinib to overcome MET-mediated resistance. We have a clinical trial up front where we give osimertinib plus gefitinib, two EGFR inhibitors,
wow,
which suppress different types of resistance.
Wow.
Osimertinib suppresses T790M, gefitinib suppresses C797S. Interesting approach. There was data at ASCO about combining gefitinib with chemotherapy, and that EGFR inhibitor therapy plus chemotherapy might be better than an EGFR TKI alone. I'm not very excited about that. You know, my patients with an EGFR mutation, I see them every 3 months. You know, they just check in, they go back to their lives. And so I don't want to add chemo to that and sort of complicate their illness without really obvious evidence of an improved outcome. I don't do a lot of EGFR inhibitor therapy plus VEGF therapy. I don't give bevacizumab very much, again, because in my patients on oral therapy, I want them to have a good quality of life and not need to come in, you know, every few weeks for IV therapy if I can avoid it.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know? You know, that was a story that came out a couple of years ago. There was some more recent data looking at EGFR TKI and Bev.
Yeah. So that was a phase 2 trial initially done in Japan where erlotinib versus erlotinib plus bevacizumab improved PFS. It was quite a striking improvement. Again, it was a population with no brain mets, so it wasn't clear if it was applicable to all of our patients. That phase 2 data showing improved PFS has not then turned into an overall survival benefit. And so while it led to approval in Europe about giving erlotinib plus bevacizumab, it hasn't transformed our treatment paradigm. Some docs use it. It is being studied with osimertinib plus bevacizumab, but it's not a major part of our practice at Dana-Farber.
You know, targeted therapy in lung cancer certainly has been exciting. You see patients really benefiting, living longer, but it seems inevitable that these patients have progressive disease. Do you think that these combination strategies maybe will lead to a situation where either the patient could be cured or maybe maintained in a chronic disease state the way you see with CML?
So that's our hope. I think what's exciting about osimertinib is it is so tolerable that we can now start playing with adding other tools to osimertinib to make it better and maybe prevent resistance. For example, my colleague Pasiane has a preclinical model where if you add a MEK inhibitor to EGFR inhibitor therapy, you can actually cure models and prevent any resistance from developing. And so that's led to a trial where we are giving upfront for newly diagnosed EGFR mutant lung cancer, osimertinib plus selumetinib, a MEK inhibitor, which we hope through vertical inhibition of the pathway can maybe prevent any resistance from developing. I mean, this is a hope and it needs to be studied, but that idea that we could build off of osimertinib to do even better and stop resistance before it starts, That would be great. We're not there yet, and it requires a lot more work.
Where are we today with targeted therapy in the adjuvant setting? There's the Alchemist trial out there. Where do you see that heading? You would think that using a drug like osimertinib would be way, way easier than trying to use erlotinib for a couple of years, as has been done. Any predictions or any guesses about when we might start seeing data for that strategy and what you think we're going to see?
The paradigm is very real, right? In breast cancer, you use targeted therapies to prevent recurrence. In GIST, you use targeted therapies to prevent recurrence, and you, in fact, change the biology of the disease. And so I think, yes, we should be looking at this in genotype-driven lung cancer. The challenge in the Alchemist study has been that patients, after completing surgery and chemo, they're worn down. They aren't always interested and taking a pill for a couple more years. And so it does require that we as the providers understand this is a compelling rationale to prevent brain mets, prevent bone mets, and sort of alter the biology of recurrence when it occurs. One trial randomized patients to EGFR inhibitor therapy versus chemotherapy. This is an Asian trial that showed improved disease-free survival when you use pill therapy instead of chemo. I'm not willing yet to not offer chemo, right? I think chemo is an important part of curative therapy. And so to my mind, the approach is give the chemo and then study targeted therapy added to chemotherapy. And so that's the model in the Alchemist trial, which I'm involved in. That's the model in the adjuvant AURA trial, which studies osimertinib. You are right that these patients who are potentially cured, they want a tolerable drug. They don't want toxicity for 2 years after surgery. And so you're right that if you're going to give erlotinib or crizotinib, you need to sort of find a dose the patient can tolerate. And one of the attractive parts about osimertinib is perhaps they could tolerate it better. But even osimertinib has some side effects. And so these are patients where, you know, they want to live like a survivor. And so to find the dose they're going to tolerate, it requires some negotiation with their provider to get them at that point and to convince them, look, this pill can really help you prevent that cancer from coming back. I think the potential is real. It just needs to be proven in clinical trials.
You know, it's always interesting when you have something that makes a lot of sense, but you don't have data. And this has been a question, you know, for many years now, ever since this strategy came out, which is the patient who can pay for the drug or the patient is very knowledgeable and says to you, I would like to try adjuvant osimertinib outside a trial. How would you feel about doing that?
There is data of adjuvant erlotinib outside of a trial. I've not seen any data of adjuvant osimertinib, so I'm not sure I would go there yet. There's at least phase two data with adjuvant erlotinib. But even then, you know, in a stage two lung cancer patient, there's a 50% chance they're cured, right? And so you're going to give them years of oral therapy feeling like a cancer patient, even though their cancer is never going to come back. And so I have done it before in like really high risk stage 3Bs, a young patient where we did chemo radiation followed by surgery. I gave this patient adjuvant crizotinib for a couple of years. She was ALK positive. She did great. And then we decided to take a break and she's been cancer free. And so I have done it before to motivated young patients with really high risk cancers, but I've never tried it off label for a stage two where I think there's the alternative, which is watch closely and give it when they come back, is also very reasonable, as long as you monitor closely and make sure they have a chance to benefit from the approach when the cancer recurs.
You know, another targeted strategy that makes a lot of sense that we don't have data on with locally advanced disease is the idea of giving targeted therapy prior to chemo radiation, decrease the radiation fields, you know, just get some anti-tumor effect going. Again, I know that was being looked at in a trial. I don't know if it is anymore. What about that strategy outside a trial setting?
Yeah, we do have phase two data from a trial edit of MGH of giving afatinib before chemoradiation, and it's very feasible. You know, it doesn't get in the way of curative therapy. I would use that in patients who have really high burden disease where you're worried about the feasibility of chemoradiation and you want to sort of debulk the tumor to make chemoradiation more successful. I don't do it routinely if the disease is small volume, but I might use it as another tool if I want to sort of debulk the cancer first and make sure the radiation can be done in a safe and feasible way.
So let's talk a little bit about ALK, and maybe we can hear about your 55-year-old man.
So this guy, young patient from a sort of a state outside of Massachusetts, feeling really well, presents with this lung mass. This is actually presented outside of Dana-Farber. He came to see me after having surgery. And at that point, because he was an ever smoker, I suggested getting some molecular testing to figure out the characteristics of his cancer and see if he might be a candidate for adjuvant targeted therapy trials. He ended up being ALK positive, and that has two impacts to me. First, I gave him platinum pemetrexed. He got cisplatin pemetrexed. We know pemetrexed is particularly active in ALK. And so I really wanted to use a pemetrexed backbone, which back then was less standard, now I think is more standard. And then after completing chemo, we looked for clinical trial options. Actually, the Alchemist ALK arm was not enrolling at that time, so he didn't able to go on. And so he was ostensibly cured, and he ended up being followed for a couple of years. And after 2 years went by, his cancer did come back quite symptomatically in the bone and in the lung. You know, could adjuvant crizotinib have impacted that? Maybe, right? Maybe that could have pushed his recurrence out. Could it have cured that? I don't know. That's what the clinical trial is hoping to show. In the end, his cancer was, yes, symptomatic, but he managed to then get started on first-line ALK therapy. At that time, was crizotinib, and it actually worked really well. He responded. He felt great. He was on crizotinib for a year, and at that point, he then developed some regrowth in the lung and with this large brain met. He actually had a 4-centimeter brain met. This is one of the big flaws of crizotinib, right? It's not a great brain drug. We know that patients on crizotinib can fail in the brain. And so he had brain surgery to remove this tumor and then came to see me for systemic and CNS failure on crizotinib. He was thinking about getting whole brain radiation. And that's when I talked to him about sort of next generation treatment of ALK resistance. And we had a couple drugs available at that point, ceritinib, alectinib, and brigatinib had just been FDA approved for treating crizotinib resistance. And so we started on brigatinib, which has really nice data in the clinical trial, at least showing it can control crizotinib resistance. And he did great. He had no side effects on brigatinib. He did the standard dosing where he started at 90 milligrams a day for the first week, then increased to 180 milligrams a day starting week two, no side effects, and had a terrific brain response. For him, it lasted about 8 months before he ended up failing again in the brain, and now we're trying to figure out the next steps for his CNS progression.
Just to backtrack, when he went on the brigatinib, was that on a trial?
Nope, it had just been FDA approved. It was the new drug on the market, and I had treated one more patient with it before him, and I pitched it to him really because this was our latest treatment of resistance and had impressive phase two data from the ALTA trial.
In general, if you see a patient like this who's had disease progression on first-line crizotinib, because obviously alectinib would be another choice, any preferences?
Yeah, those are the two drugs I talk to patients about for crizotinib resistance. Both are impressive. Alectinib, really impressive tolerability. Brigatinib, impressive tolerability with this small subset of patients who can get lung inflammation during that first week on therapy. For him, he wanted to be aggressive and get the best outcomes. And the data was impressive with the ALTA phase two trial of brigatinib, 12-month or longer median PFS. So really good not only at getting a response, but at preventing crizotinib resistance. And so that's why we went with brigatinib. The alectinib data for crizotinib resistance is a little less impressive, more like an 8-month median PFS, maybe doesn't quite cover all the same resistance mutations as brigatinib. And so that's why in his case, we ended up choosing brigatinib. But I've had other patients who are a little more nervous maybe. I had a kind of more nervous patient who was worried about the potential for brigatinib toxicity, and therefore she ended up picking alectinib. I present both options to patients.
And can you talk a little bit more about this pulmonary toxicity that's seen, the pathophysiology and clinical presentation and management?
It's not pneumonitis, right? So it's not like the pneumonitis we see that occurs 4, 6, 8 months into therapy and causes you to stop the drug. This is a sort of fairly early, almost allergic reaction that patients get. They can develop cough, shortness of breath. It usually occurs in that first week. And so what they figured out during early drug development was if you give the dose at 90 milligrams a day for the first week and then increase to 180 milligrams a day, you can prevent that a lung reaction from occurring most of the time. And in the eventual clinical trial, the phase two trial, I think the incidence was only in the range of 6%. And so that's, you know, pretty uncommon. If you do see it, if you do get these respiratory symptoms during the first week, the patient needs to stop the drug, needs to make sure it recovers. You can rechallenge again, and some patients can continue on therapy, but it certainly is an alarming symptom you need to make sure patients are aware of.
Have you seen it? And in terms of what's been reported, how severe can it be?
I've not seen it myself. It can be very severe. In the phase one trial, when they looked at higher doses of brigatinib, it can be extremely severe, and I think they even had a fatality. At the 90 milligrams followed by 180, it seems to be quite manageable. The important point is if you're going to prescribe the drug, don't just write for 180. Like, you really do want to give that 90 milligram 1 week lead-in and sort of check with the patient during that first week. And then once they get to the second week, honestly, the drug is very well tolerated and it can be smooth sailing for a long time.
And are corticosteroids used?
Yeah, if they do develop symptoms, you can give them steroids, interrupt, you know, monitor, get a chest x-ray. Don't need a hospitalization necessarily, but yes, steroids can. You just want to quickly turn this reaction off and get them back to feeling normal.
Can you talk a little bit about how you approach? I'm guessing right now, typically you're using alectinib first line?
Yes. So my standard first line ALK therapy is alectinib, which is very well tolerated. In the ALK trials shows really very prolonged PFS. I don't find that everyone responds. Amazingly, there are still some patients who just have an aggressive biology and have a transient benefit, but the vast majority of patients can respond systemically and in the brain. And it's, you know, led to PFSs in the range of 2-3 years or longer for some patients. And so I have some patients on alectinib for a very long time.
What do we know about the mechanisms of resistance to alectinib? And clinically, outside a trial setting, what do you do?
I think it's worth thinking about alectinib resistance or ALK resistance in general, much like EGFR resistance, right? So you can have on-target resistance. And on-target resistance is caused by secondary resistance mutations. So if you, after alectinib, see an on-target resistance mechanism like the ALK G1202R resistance mutation, that is a resistance mutation that you can overcome by finding a different ALK inhibitor. And so the best data on this actually now comes from the recent trials of lorlatinib. Lorlatinib is one of the most potent new ALK inhibitors that can overcome a range of resistance mechanisms. If you see an ALK mutation, so if you see a secondary ALK mutation, then lorlatinib has a nice response rate and can overcome resistance. But in your patient with alectinib resistance, if you don't see a secondary ALK mutation, they do not have on-target resistance, they have off-target resistance. The cancer has just gone haywire in a new direction. And in those patients where I steer them to chemotherapy. Now, this paradigm of using resistance genotyping to guide ALK resistance therapy, it's not widespread. It's not really proven prospectively in the way that it is with T790M. I mean, in T790M, it's very clear. Resistance, you know, T790M goes to osimertinib, no T790M goes to chemo. That same model, I think, deserves further investigation for ALK. ALK resistance mechanism, try a better ALK inhibitor. No resistance mechanism, try chemotherapy. And that's the kind of paradigm I'm trying to look into more and more for my patients.
Where do you see things heading in terms of management of patients with ALK translocations? Are there other studies right now in the first line that are maturing?
Well, the question is, are these newer ALK inhibitors going to move to the first line setting? And so could brigatinib replace alectinib? First line trials ongoing of brigatinib versus crizotinib. Could lorlatinib replace alectinib? First line trials ongoing of lorlatinib versus crizotinib. And newer ALK inhibitors that are not yet in the clinic or are not yet sort of widely available, but are coming along. I think lorlatinib is the most interesting new drug to be aware of. It can be well tolerated, but it has a certain weird subset of side effects. Patients generally develop high cholesterol. I mean, high cholesterol is easy enough. You start a cholesterol medication. But high cholesterol, along with weight gain and sort of metabolic derangements, and then the cholesterol medication makes their CK go up maybe. And so for some patients, it can get complicated. I had a patient who gained, I think, 40 pounds on lorlatinib, and we had to put him on a kind of Atkins diet in order to cut the carbs out. So it can be kind of weird. I think plenty of patients tolerate it fine. Some patients can have the sort of metabolic derangement that makes it a little more work, but it is a good drug for brain mets. It's certainly a drug to be aware of, and I think will impact resistance therapy soon.
That's really fascinating. Let's talk a little bit about RET alterations. Sounds like some exciting things going on.
Yeah.
Maybe we can hear about your 47-year-old patient.
So this is a young father living outside of Boston, young kids, very active, working full-time, developed a cough, a lung mass, and his CAT scan showed this lung mass and some other lung nodules contralateral. He had stage 4 disease. Honestly, the RET inhibitor therapy, when he first presented, was limited to these multi-kinase inhibitors, which are cabozantinib, vendetinib. We did next-gen sequencing. I was hoping for EGFR or ALK, found this RET rearrangement. He was not too symptomatic, so I was able to wait for the NGS results to come back. We actually ended up proceeding to biopsy the other side to confirm stage 4 disease and making sure it was actually contralateral. And when his results did come back, we found the NGS results, we found the RET rearrangement, and we saw PD-L1 90%. So this is an interesting question for this patient. Okay, we have PD-L1, a very compelling approach. Should we use first-line pembrolizumab or RET? At that time, cabozantinib, not a very compelling approach, has a lot of toxicities. or chemotherapy. And I think, you know, given those three approaches, he very reasonably said, look, I want to try pembrolizumab. Maybe there's a chance that I can have a response to this. I think this is one of those cases where I see sort of high PD-L1 asterisk, right? Because he doesn't have a high tumor burden. He's a non-smoker. And as expected, first-line pembrolizumab, though it's on label for this patient, didn't pan out. If he were really symptomatic, I probably wouldn't have offered pembrolizumab alone. Fortunately, he didn't have too many symptoms. He could afford trying it for a couple of months, and really his cancer just grew. And by that point, he was developing more symptoms, and we now face a different question, right? Immunotherapy is not going to work for him. Do we look for a RET inhibitor or do we do chemotherapy? And right now, this is last summer, the LOXO-292 trial was just opening and enrolling at our center. He was one of the first patients on the study at an early dose, and he started at a low dose, 20 milligrams twice a day, immediately feeling better, having a response. And the drug actually has allowed dose escalation for patients on study. So he's steadily increased to 40 twice a day, 80 twice a day. He's at 160 milligrams twice a day and still has no toxicities from the drug, has had a really dramatic response in his lung disease, which has all melted away. And he's still on the drug feeling really, really well. His only complication is he has developed recurrence of a pleural effusion. So he had a pleural catheter placed. We're draining that. And I guess I'm worried that resistance might be developing. We might need to think about what to do next. But in the meantime, he's feeling terrific on oral therapy.
This is a TKI, correct?
Yes.
And right now, what do we know about its activity and toxicity? How many patients have been reported with it?
At ASCO, there was more than 70 patients that have been treated on this sort of dose escalation, early multi-drugs, multi-levels, and a lot of dose expansion. The drug is mostly studying lung cancer, which has RET fusions, and thyroid cancer. Thyroid cancer has RET point mutations and RET fusions. And so it's kind of an equal balance of these, a couple other rare patients with other RET rearrangements. You can see RET rearrangements also in pancreatic cancer, rarely in colon cancer, even in breast cancer sometimes, so it's worth keeping an eye out for them.
So this is kind of a basket study?
It's a phase one study, right? It's an early study allowing anyone who might be eligible. It's actually now reached its phase two dose, which is 160 milligrams twice daily, and is proceeding now in a phase two expansion. And the expansion is in lung cancer, RET positive, either TKI naive or TKI pretreated, thyroid cancer, either TKI naive or TKI pretreated, or a basket arm that allows any RET rearranged or RET positive cancers that don't fit in the other arms. And so that phase two is right now enrolling. In the phase one, amazingly, there was really very little toxicity. I mean, I think the DLTs in the end at the higher dose was tumor lysis syndrome, if you can imagine.
Wow.
Right? So the drug is very potent for RET. It hits wild type RET, which is the RET that you see in RET rearrangements, and it inhibits mutant RET. So it overcomes resistance mutations, we think, and has really no off-target toxicities. And so I think it's going to be another real home run, much like osimertinib and alectinib, potent inhibition and durable responses, but we need to see that in phase two.
Any other RET inhibitors out there that are similarly exciting?
So there is a second drug also being developed at the same time, another potent RET inhibitor, intelligently designed to inhibit RET without other targets, and also is in dose escalation, I think has now gone to dose expansion, also very tolerable. Both of these drugs are out there for our patients. And so it's like whichever center is closer to you, get your patients on these trials because these drugs really can make an impact.
And I guess we've gone past the whole concepts of IPASS type studies where targeted therapy is compared to chemotherapy. It seems like nowadays, if you see something like this, you see a high response rate targeted therapy, it's going first line?
It's a great question. I mean, I think the regulatory approach differs a little bit around the globe. Increasingly in the US, the FDA has said, look, it's just when you have a drug that has this kind of efficacy and tolerability, like either of these two new potent RET inhibitors, it's almost unethical to randomize them versus chemotherapy when you know this drug is so effective. I think in other parts of the world, there still is a need for randomized trials to sort of move the regulatory bar. And so I think that's a question a lot of companies are struggling with. It's a big question whether you're going to launch a randomized trial when you can see this obvious activity. So my impression is that yes, today it's ethical and appropriate to use these drugs first line if you can get the patients onto the trial. Whether the trials will allow it, I mean, that's a moving target. But it feels like these will replace chemo for these patients.
I'm just thinking now, I think dabrafenib, trametinib was approved without a comparative study, right, to chemo, or was there one?
True, no comparative study, but let's remember that that combination has extensive randomized data in melanoma, right? So that's an already approved combination in melanoma where we know this combination is better than chemo in melanoma, where you know two drugs is better than one drug already in melanoma. And so you can sort of tag along on that regulatory path to say, here, we think those principles apply in lung cancer as well. And so I think it's a slightly different story. With these RET inhibitors, you need to have a plan in lung cancer and in thyroid cancer. And we should be clear, in thyroid cancer, vandetanib is approved. Cabozantinib is approved. So there are standard of care multi-kinase RET inhibitors, and we need to figure out a plan to, in many ways, replace those with these likely more effective, certainly more tolerable drugs.
It's interesting when you ask investigators. We did a project with Craig Riley about a year and a half ago, and I think you're one of the people you actually surveyed and just asked people what they were doing outside a trial setting in terms of first-line therapy. Clearly, obviously, EGFR, ALK, and ROS1 was straightforward. But I think that BRAF people were using in first line, but also people were using for MET exon 14 crizotinib, which isn't approved. Is that your approach to those patients, first line crizotinib?
I have done that. I mean, my experience in MET exon 14 cancers is that they can be very aggressive, right? They can really be explosively aggressive. And so I had a patient where I started chemo and then the MET came back. They were already failing chemo after one cycle. I switched them to MET. If their cancer was well controlled enough, I might start with MET up front. It's true that crizotinib is a multi-kinase inhibitor of ALK, ROS, and MET, so it can be used to target MET. I think you have to personalize that for the patient. The response rate in PFS data for crizotinib and MET exon 14 hasn't been as impressive. I mean, you can certainly see responses. They're transient. The median PFS, I think, is only in the range of 5 or 6 months. So I think there was a lot of optimism that that would move the bar. I'm not sure the clinical data has panned out quite as much. And so that's still an unanswered question for me.
As long as we're talking about MET, maybe we can hear about your 51-year-old patient.
Yeah, this is an amazing case. So she's a patient with multiple lung nodules, bone metastases, presented a couple years ago now. And we did standard genotyping. Actually, at our institute, that's NGS. She was asymptomatic enough that I could wait a couple weeks to get the NGS back and didn't show EGFR, ALK, ROS. It showed only MET amplification. And I'm not sure about MET amplification as a real target, but for her, it was really impressive. You know, in a clear outlier, I'm looking to see a driver, and the only thing I can see is this obvious MET peak on the amplogram. And so for her, I said, look, I don't know if we can target this. I know we might be able to. I started on first-line chemo, which is standard of care, but I said, look, I think MET is an exciting place. There are going to be drugs coming along. You know, when you do progress, let's look at MET inhibitor trials. And so eventually, it was actually after about a year, I think, her cancer did progress. She developed a new liver metastasis. And I said, all right, remember those trials? Let's go for it. And so I screened her for one trial of a MET multi-kinase inhibitor. They checked her tumor. They said, sorry, not positive enough, FISH negative, not eligible. I checked her for another trial. There's actually a crizotinib trial that's still enrolling of these MET amplified patients. And they said, sorry, not positive, can't go on the study. I was like, this is crazy. Like, this is a non-smoker. She's got a driver. The only thing in here is MET. Like, this patient is going to respond to a MET inhibitor. But if you won't treat her, I'll treat her. And so I wrote for crizotinib. I got it approved by her insurance. And in the end, she's had an amazing response, right? She's had a terrific response. She's been on it now for a year. Feels fantastic. And so it shows how complicated MET amplification is as a biomarker, right? This is not a splice mutation. There are two different METs you can target with crizotinib. Exon 14 splice mutations, one type of aggressive biology occurs in older individuals, and yet there's also these MET amplified cases. MET exon 14 mutations can be amplified, but not all MET amplifieds are MET exon 14 mutation. And so we have a couple of these cases where I've tried crizotinib off-label. It doesn't always work. Sometimes MET amplification you can see along with a KRAS mutation or something. That's not going to respond. But in some of these outliers, I do think MET is a real target, and it's worth remembering that some of them can respond.
There's also MET overexpression, right?
Yeah. MET overexpression by IHC has also been looked at. For example, there was the MET-MAB story where MET was studied with erlotinib. That was negative. So MET overexpression is not a biomarker in lung cancer, but you do have to keep an eye out for high MET amplification, not low level, not medium level, high level MET amplification can be targeted, or these MET exon 14 mutations.
So in terms of new targets, we're hearing a lot about TRK fusions, entrectinib, larotrectinib. Is that the next big targetable alteration?
Yeah, I mean, that data is amazing because it's across really all cancer types, and especially in pediatric cancers, right, which is fascinating. And so this is a real space. Entrectinib, to be clear, entrectinib is actually a ROS inhibitor and a TRK inhibitor. So entrectinib may have real potential as a ROS drug instead of crizotinib, very good in the brain. And then larotrectinib and even newer potent TRK inhibitors, which have had this amazing TRK response across disease types. You see it in colon cancer. You could see it in subsarcomas. I think this reminds us that in those NGS reports, you got to keep an eye out for these fascinating rare phenomena, which can be targeted.
What exactly is TRK?
It's another fusion oncoprotein, so it's another fusion. Our reports show fusions in a separate place. And so it's another fusion like RET and like ROS and like ALK. It's another oncoprotein that through this fusion event is turned on and leads to constitutive signaling.
What do we know about the impact of targeted therapy in these patients?
Oh, amazing. Spectacular waterfall responses, very durable responses. In some of the pediatric patients, they can use them to shrink the tumors and then convert them to curative therapy, right? So big tumors that shrink, big sarcomas shrink, and then you can cure them through resection. So really amazing activity, very durable activity, quite well tolerated, can impact nociception or pain sensors. So it can have some slightly weird toxicity, sometimes some neurologic toxicity if you hit CNS TRK too potently. But overall, you know, great responses and well tolerated and worth looking out for.
This would pop up on an NGS assay, for example?
Yeah, I mean, we should acknowledge that not all NGS assays find fusions.
Right.
Not all NGS assays are perfect for all the various fusions. Probably the best way to find fusions is RNA sequencing, which is kind of a rare angle that not a lot of labs do. So you do need to make sure that the tests you are sending are looking for all these rare things. But, you know, certainly the Foundation One test is now an FDA-approved approach to look for common and rare stuff, and I think is going to be a reference point for a lot of these developments going forward.
And if you saw a patient who had this abnormality who was untreated, would you attempt to get them on a trial first line?
Yes. I mean, you know, getting them on a trial can take some work, but generally the biotechs investing in this space will help get your patients to trials, provide transport support. You know, so certainly reach out and say, how can I get this patient out there? You might need to start chemo while you're working on it, but find a way to get into these drugs. They can really make an impact.
We were talking before about BRAF, and I see you have this 74-year-old lady. Can you talk a little bit about her?
Yeah. So this lady is an older, never smoker. She initially presented with a lung mass and underwent resection of, I think it was a 1.5 centimeter lung cancer. Not very high risk, negative lymph node. She ended up recurring actually just about a year later. You know, one advantage of these resection specimens is at our institution, we do NGS of all of these resected lung cancers. And so we sort of have the genotype saved for when the patient recurs. And so when she did recur, we knew of that BRAF mutation. I will say, when I look back, I wonder, why did a 1.5 centimeter lung cancer with no lymph nodes recur so quickly? And so actually, there was an amazing presentation at ASCO about lymph node quality and about how we need to better ensure that our surgeries have a lot of lymph nodes checked to be accurate staging.
Yeah, what was that all about?
Oh, it's amazing data out of Memphis where if you give the surgeons a Tupperware with holes to put the lymph nodes in and tell them, please put the lymph nodes in these spots and make sure you get them all, then the quality of the surgery and the lymph node sampling goes up. They track the lymph nodes, they get into the pathologist, and if you take the Tupperware again, take the kit away, then their surgical quality goes back down to normal. And so effectively, if we help the system, the surgeon and the pathologist, do high-quality surgeons get these lymph nodes, then we do better staging. We find lymph nodes and we can better give adjuvant therapy. And this patient, in the end, there weren't a lot of lymph nodes. She was an older patient. It was a small surgery they did. And so she ended up not getting adjuvant chemo and recurred fairly quickly thereafter, about a year. Pericardial disease, bone metastases, and we knew we had this BRAF mutation. And so we sent her straight to first-line BRAF therapy with dabrafenib, trametinib. And she did great. I mean, the important difference from this regimen as compared to alectinib or EGFR is that it does have real toxicities, rash and fever. You got to keep an eye out for the fever. If they develop the fever, you can just take a break from therapy for a few days or a week, start it up again. But over time, they can tolerate it great. And she's had a terrific response and has been now on therapy for lasting about a year.
And can you talk a little bit more about her toxicity that she experienced?
Mostly just that fever reaction, which was early on. She's not had any rash. She's not had any diarrhea or nausea. So after you sort of get through that early fever management, patients can do really well.
And do you generally dose reduce them because of the fever, or are you able to restart at the same dose?
Good question. You should try to restart at the same dose. Many patients can still tolerate. If the fever recurs, then you dose reduce and you try to get the lower dose to work.
What's this patient's current situation? She's tolerating therapy and doing well?
Still responding, yeah, after a year. I will say, it's not like we have any treatments for BRAF resistance right now. And so she's looking at chemotherapy if that happens. And that's still a sort of unmet need. Resistance in melanoma can be very aggressive after BRAF therapy. In lung cancer, not so much. And we're still trying to figure out how do you then tailor treatment of resistance.
We're going to talk in the other part of this program about management of people without targetable mutations. But I have to get your take after this past ASCO of where you are today in first-line therapy of metastatic disease and how you use PD-L1 and tumor mutation burden to make your decisions.
I think the data is convincing that I and pretty much everyone else are moving towards chemoimmunotherapy. That's clear now in non-squamous, where you can give carbo-pem, pembrolizumab. That's now increasingly clear in squamous, where we have multiple trials showing benefit of adding immunotherapy to doublet therapy. And in fact, there was just a press release about in small cell lung cancer, adding immunotherapy to doublet chemotherapy. No data, but a press release saying that atezolizumab improves PFS and overall survival in small cell lung cancer. And so the writing's on the wall that we are moving towards chemoimmunotherapy for more and more of our lung cancer patients.
What do you think's going on when you see this benefit with chemotherapy added to immunotherapy? Do you think it's just 1+1, or is there some kind of synergy?
Great question. I think it's 1+1. I think this is an additive effect and not a synergistic effect. And the reason I say that is if you look at those PD-L1 negatives, right, if it's synergistic, I would want those PD-L1 negatives to be having clearly added benefit of adding IO to chemo. And what I see is that the PFS curves are fairly parallel. There's not a real difference in PFS. What you see is a difference in OS by adding them up front. And what I think this is that you're giving the patient a chance to respond to two different approaches. And these are two approaches that can safely be given together with a little bit of extra toxicity, but don't need to be given together. I don't think we're transforming patients into IO responders by adding it to chemotherapy. And in that regard, I still would rather give single agent IO. In my patient who is relatively asymptomatic and doesn't have a huge disease burden, in my patient who has a really high PD-L1 as a former smoker, I still prefer single agent pembrolizumab alone. I still prefer to give immunotherapy because I have plenty of patients now who got immunotherapy alone, had that dramatic response, 2 years go by, they're off immunotherapy, 2 more years go by, and they are still in remission, right? I want patients to have that experience of few toxicities, great response. The gamble is in that patient who has lower level PD-L1, medium smoking history, you're not sure if chemo's better or immunotherapy's better, and you say, look, let's just go for it and give both together. And I've done that in some PS2 patients where I was really worried about them. I was like, we have one shot here. Let's pile our drugs on, try to get a response. And if they tolerate it, it maximizes your chance of getting a good outcome.
What about, you mentioned the data that's been coming out very, very recently on chemotherapy and immunotherapy in squamous. Right now, what do you think is the ideal regimen for a patient like that?
Right now, I've not done it yet. It's not changed the FDA label. The most impressive data to me was carboplatin, paclitaxel, pembrolizumab. And so the next time I see an advanced squamous, that's going to be a hard conversation that I'm going to have. I'm not sure that's being reimbursed yet, but I think we can see that the bar is moving. And pretty soon we're going to be giving upfront triplet therapy. It just depends on how the data matures and which of that data leads to a regulatory approval first.
If you could, would you rather use nab-paclitaxel and avoid the steroids?
There was also some data with carbo-nab-paclitaxel. You know, nab-paclitaxel is weekly. I don't know if you've ever driven into Longwood in Boston, but it's a pain in the butt. And so my patients don't tend to like weekly visits. In patients who can tolerate the weekly visits, it's a reasonable approach. I guess it does depend how the label comes together. You know, in terms of cost, nab-paclitaxel costs more. Pembrolizumab costs more. What's the most important piece there? I would negotiate for the pembrolizumab before I'd negotiate for the nab-paclitaxel. And so we'll see which of those ends up going into a label.
You mentioned small cell before, and I wanted to ask you because I know there was a data set presented on so-called Rova-T, the antibody-drug conjugate. Can you talk about what that is and what we know about that right now?
This is a really important new class of drugs. The fact that you can take an antibody, stick onto that antibody a payload of chemotherapy, and hone it in to the cancer is hugely important, okay? This is the same model as T-DM1, a drug we're familiar with, and this is gonna be a whole new class of drugs coming along that we need to be aware of, okay? So Rova-T is, you know, the first one of these to make any impact in lung cancer. It is a payload that homes in to small cell lung cancers, and not all patients stain positive, but it is real that some patients have a response. I think the question I'm struggling with for my small cell lung cancer patients is which patients are going to benefit and which patients not. It does have toxicities. What we found is that some patients on this drug can develop pleural effusions, sometimes refractory pleural effusions, but at the same time, it's obvious that it's causing responses. And so in small cell lung cancer, what we're seeing is more tools coming along. Data with nivolumab, data with ipi-nivolumab, certainly data with single-agent chemotherapy. You know, I see dramatic chemotherapy responses. Data with PARP inhibitors. There was a neat publication in JCO of topotecan with a PARP inhibitor. So there are new targeted therapies coming from small cell. How do we piece these together to turn these patients into responders? I'm not quite sure yet. I think Rova-T will be part of that story, but I can't quite figure out yet which of my patients are the ones who should get that.
PARP inhibitors in people without BRCA mutations?
Right. This is as a way of sensitizing to chemotherapy, looking for synergy. Recent publication by Pietanza et al. With Temodar with PARP inhibitor therapy. And actually an additional combination, a phase 2 trial being led by Anna Farrow at MGH, looking at that approach as well, has some real toxicities. But you know, here's an oral targeted therapy approach. I don't know, targeted therapy, chemo-targeted therapy approach that can work for small cell, that'd be pretty cool, worth keeping an eye out for.
You mentioned ipi-nivo in small cell, and I'm hearing more investigators say that's their second-line therapy. Is that yours?
We are increasingly using it off-label. I will say for some of my small cell lung cancer patients who are a little more delicate in terms of performance status, I'm more using single-agent immunotherapy. Not for all patients, but it's definitely a conversation. But I have those patients where irinotecan led to a response for 2 years, right? So I don't give up on going back to chemotherapy. It's not my standard, but it's definitely a conversation. When I have that conversation with patients, most patients say, really, doc, I want to try the immunotherapy, you know? And so patients are really asking for it. What we need is data to make that a standard part of small cell.
You mentioned ipi-nivo. What about ipi-nivo or anti-CTLA-4, PD-1 in non-small cell and tumor mutation burden? Where do you see that heading?
Yeah, and that's fascinating data. I think they're two different questions, right? The ipi-nivo question is, in those patients who could respond to immunotherapy, can you do more? By hitting the immune system harder, can you get them that immunotherapy response? I think the challenge there with ipi-nivo is we now have chemo, pembro, right? And so, you know, which of these two approaches are better? That's a difficult question, I think, and has not really been clearly answered. I think it's going to be hard to move chemo pembro out of our standard toolkit up front. Still, the idea of two checkpoints is compelling. Every time I offer it to patients on clinical trials, they're into it. And so I think we're going to have to figure out a way to how to build it in. Before you know it, we might be offering chemo, ipi, nivo, maybe, right? I think we need to see these trials. TMB is a separate question. I think TMB is the question of when you see a patient and you're trying to figure out, are they going to be immunosensitive versus not? What pieces do you pull into that question, right? And so just like PD-L1 positive comes with an asterisk sometimes because it's PD-L1 positive, but they're genetically simple EGFR or ALK, at the same time, PD-L1 negative comes with an asterisk. And if you have a PD-L1 negative heavy smoker with high TMB, look, there's a patient where maybe you can get that awesome response to immunotherapy alone and spare them chemotherapy. And so, yes, I would love to be able to offer them ipi-nivo, but it would be off-label because that PD-L1 is negative.
So final question. You mentioned earlier with one of the patients you presented the issue of pulmonary toxicity in patients on checkpoint inhibitors. And I think the case you were talking about, you weren't sure. The patient got chemo as well as checkpoint inhibitor. Can you talk a little bit about how you approach the patient with pulmonary problems who's on maybe not just the checkpoint inhibitor, maybe with chemo, and then, you know, maybe with a history of chronic lung disease on top of that, how you sort of sort that out clinically?
That's a really great question. I think about grading. We have to learn our grading, right? Grade 1 pulmonary toxicity is scans only, no symptoms, right? If the radiologist says, worried about pneumonitis and the patient feels great, watch it, continue treating, right? We should not let grade 1 pulmonary toxicity divert us from effective therapy. Grade two is when they start to get symptoms, okay? They're having a cough. Oh yeah, by the way, I am developing more cough. So I just had a patient like this who was doing great on chemo pembro, was in maintenance phase on pemetrexed with pembrolizumab. And the radiologist was like, you know, this scan's not looking normal. And the patient's like, well, yeah, I have had more cough over the past 3 weeks. I said, all right, time out. Like, this is the beginning of something. And this could get bad if we don't make a move. So I stopped the pembrolizumab. I continued the pemetrexed, the chemo was fine, and I added steroids. And when you look, there's a great review in the JCO about this recently by Julie Brommer. I mean, the regimen, it's a very real, you know, high dose of steroids, 60 milligrams a day or more, and you give it over a long taper. You really want to turn that off and taper them off steroids over a cover of several weeks. And what you're trying to do is prevent that grade two from becoming grade three, grade four, serious, hospitalized, very sick, right? If it gets to grade three or grade four, they're in the hospital, they're hypoxic, you know, that's when you start worrying you're never going to retreat them. And by not retreating them, you might withdraw the ability for them to ever get the benefit from that. In the grade four, you know, sick patient, ICU, you know, I've seen that, a serious toxicity from IO, they never see IO again. The grade three, where they're sort of hospitalized but manageable, and you get them on steroids, you get them better again, maybe you can reintroduce it, but it's definitely a conversation to have with the whole team and make sure the patient knows that this can happen again.
It's funny, you're mentioning Julie Brommer's paper. Imagine if I told you 3 years ago, there'd be a 70-page article on the toxicity of the immunotherapy.
I mean, I've pulled that up and looked through those tables so many times since then. We just launched our own inpatient service at the Brigham to manage immunotherapy toxicity. Like,
wow.
This is a big deal and you got to get it right. But we can get it right. And through getting it right, we can help patients benefit.